Hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. That's why when it comes to hard work, nothing works harder than a Chevy Silverado. No wonder Chevy Silverado is the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Check out a new Silverado at ChevyDriveChicago.com.
Look, if you weren't happy with my presentation, then maybe you should have given it with me.
As I've explained repeatedly, unlike you, I don't need validation from lesser minds. No offense.
Really? So why did you come?
Because I knew you'd screw this up.
I didn't screw it up.
Oh, please. I admit that spherical chicken joke, that was hilarious. But it was straight downhill from there.
You know what? I've had enough of your condescension. Maybe I didn't go to college when I was 11, like you. Maybe I got my doctorate at 24 instead of 16. But you are not the only person who is smarter than everyone else in this room. No offense. And I am clearly not the only person who is tormented by insecurity and has an ego in need of constant validation.
So you admit you're an egotist?
Yes! My name is Dr. Leonard Hofstetter, and I could never please my parents, so I need to get all my self-esteem from strangers like you. But he's worse!
It all started with a big bang. It's expanding ever outward, but one day.
Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. Very excited about my first guest tonight. He is a star of the number one sitcom in America, The Big Bang Theory on CBS, but you also know him from shows like Roseanne, Entourage. He's lent his voice to TV's Family Guy, movies like perennial favorite National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, Suicide King's Vanilla Sky, and so much more. And he grew up right here in Oak Park. And here is Chicago's very own Johnny Galecki. Johnny, what's up, my friend?
Hey, David. How are you? Thanks so much for having me, man.
Absolutely. Thanks for hanging out with us. I wanted to start a little bit from your very beginnings. You were born in Belgium, and I know your dad was in the Air Force station there. When did you make your way to Chicago?
I think I want to say it was about 2.5 or 3, actually. We lived in, he went back to school in Michigan, but we ended up there in Oak Park, I'd say about 4 or 5 years old.
So what do you remember about the city as a kid, besides Mark Giangreco, which you just mentioned to me before the call started?
I did. It was one of my first questions, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Mark Giangreco still around causing trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, sure. Mark Giangreco.
That's the first thing on your list.
It was a big change from an Air Force base in Belgium and a big change from living in the sticks out in Allegan, Michigan. So, the fact that there was a fire hydrant outside the house was fascinating, right? Never mind stoplights and what have you.
Yeah. Do you remember, what did you used to do? Did you used to hang out in the city? Did you ever go to Kiddyland? Like, what are some of your fondest memories of being a kid in Chicago?
Oh, we did go to Kiddyland, yes. Yeah, there was quite a bit of, and then my mother had gone to Kiddyland. That was just a statue for that area, certainly.
Since the 1920s, and it closed about three years ago.
At that age, we're talking 4 or 5, just to have a neighbor was a big deal.
Right,
But there was the community that Chicago is, and especially the neighborhoods in Chicago is. There were block parties, there were holiday parties, there was Christmas caroling, which is unheard of nowadays for whatever reason. That all of that started to sink into me, and then later, the Chicago theater community, which was just as supportive as your next door neighbors, was obviously a massive influence on me, and really made it able for me to do what I still do today, 33 years later.
That's very cool. Do you still have friends and family here? Do you visit once in a while?
Yes, all my family is there.
Oh,
yeah,
that's great.
As much as possible.
That's
great. In a few days, as a matter of fact.
Beautiful, beautiful.
And I love it. Even in this time of year, I love it.
Right.
I know it drives people there crazy because they say, you need to deal with it, this weather, for 4 days. We deal with it for 4 months.
Right, exactly. But it's fun to come back here and see it.
Yeah. Fair enough. I get to say, wow, this is really pretty, and they just want to throttle me immediately. But it is beautiful there. And those couple those windows, and sometimes they're much too brief of spring and fall, obviously. There's no place I'd rather be.
No.
And outside of those windows, as my mother said, Chicago has 2 seasons, summer and construction.
Very true.
Winter and construction.
That's totally true. That's totally true. Now, I heard you talk about this before, and I think it was on Letterman. And when you're in a city like this, everyone gives everyone a nickname. And I had several myself.
True.
Yeah, I had several myself that.
Oh, what are those? Give me a couple of them.
My last name's Plyer.
Share with the audience.
It was Peeler. It was Pilfer. It was Piler. It was I got a lot of DPs, which also they made fun of.
No.
That would be dumb Pollock as well,
win.
Which
you
I am.
Really
no, you can't really win. What was yours?
Well, the one I think that was Conan, where we were talking.
It was Conan.
So the Conan at the Chicago Theater there, which was a really thrilling night. My God, I mean, the crowd was, what does the Chicago Theater there hold? Like 3,000?
Yeah.
Like that?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I get nervous still when I do those darn panel shows. I mean, at the end of the day, I enjoy surviving them.
Right.
But I'm sleepless for a week before Letterman, for example. And so, but you'd walk out on some stage at some place like Chicago Theater and with the history that that place has and the energy of the crowd, and you don't have to do much,
but
man. You just,
there's
you
always
kind of
excitement,
ride their
though.
Energy wave.
Yeah, we don't see you know, like the big Hollywood you know, stars here in Chicago. So when we see you here and we know you're appearing someplace, we get excited.
Well, I don't. I think that was more for Conan than me. But thank you very much.
You're
but
welcome.
But it was lovely to be able to have my family there in support at one of those things. My great aunt, who was in her 90s at the time, was there. That was a wonderful night. That nickname that we discussed was for me, that was for a couple of years there, it was Bit Fingers, which I still have no...
Bitch Fingers, which...
I have no clue why that was the the case.
Who gave you that name?
Masculine Fingers.
Yeah.
A bartender named Boosh.
Okay, so... So another guy with another nickname.
There were also many others. As you said, there was, of course, there's the Go-Lucky or Happy-Go-Lucky or,
yeah.
You know, when you have a name like Johnny, you get a lot of songs sung to you. You get Johnny Good and Johnny Angel, and it's pretty endless.
Yeah, I bet it is. Well, how did you get into acting? Because, you know, I don't think you went to school for it. You were like 11 or 12 when you first got your first gig in a miniseries. How did you get into it?
I started talking about it about the time that we moved there to Chicago. And, you know, my father worked there he taught blind veterans at Heinz VA Hospital outside of the city.
Okay.
And my mother was a mother and a housewife. There was nobody in my immediate family that could have been of any influence. I honestly have no idea how I even knew of the word actor at 3.5 years old. But that was my answer when... adults asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. And my parents, they weren't unsupportive by any means, just didn't know what to do with this odd ambition of their child. So they kind of hoped it would pass, I think, and mm-hmm. tried to distract me with soccer and t-ball and things
sure.
of that nature,
sure, sure.
Which was just an embarrassing failure. At t-ball, I would strike out up at mound. There's a ball right there, and I was on the tee. I would strike out. And when we were in the field, I was the catcher. There's no pitcher in t-ball. So basically, I was kind of like a waiter that kind of picks up your dropped fork and place it back.
But it's a sports city, though.
On the tee that you are, sir.
It's a sports city, though. You had to try it, you know.
It had to try,
absolutely. Yeah.
And then come 7 years old, we were sitting on a dinner table, and... my parents were reading the Oak Leaves, the suburban newspaper
you
there
betcha.
For the West Suburb. I'm not sure if it, I believe it does still exist.
It does, yeah.
And there was an ad for open auditions for a community theater production of Fiddler on the Roof, what was then the Village Players on South Boulevard, I believe. And they explained, you know, this is what actors need to do to get a job. The phone doesn't just ring. Do you want to go and watch people audition and learn what that is? And we did, and I ended up jumping up on stage and singing something and got a very small chorus role in the production. And but from that point on, the people in that production helped my parents learn what it would take, learn about photos and agents if I
sure.
was ever so lucky,
sure,
and things of that nature. And that's what I mean by how, I mean, that's my first example of a million of how supportive that Chicago theater community is.
That's great. So I didn't know you actually started in the theater here. That's what a cool experience as a young kid. And I love the fact
that...
Yeah,
I did that show, and then I think I did I think next was a production of Pippin, which was downtown, which was mm-hmm. a big deal.
Sure.
And then a production of Member of the Wedding, which I was nominated for a Joseph mm-hmm. Jefferson Award, and that's the agents coming by to see that performance. And I think that garnered me my first agent, which resulted in some commercials and industrial films. And I'm putting myself on tape for things that were being produced in Los Angeles.
Yeah, and you were like 14, and you were pretty much living alone out there. I mean, you were getting roles and you were getting parts while your folks were back here, your family was back here, and you were out there kind of hitting the streets and doing what you had to do to make a name for yourself.
Yeah, well, we had all moved out there when I was about 13, and honestly, that lasted about 9 or 10 months. We really missed Chicago. Mm-hmm. And by the time that we found another house back home and were ready to move back, I was under contract. And it was supposed to be for a very short amount of time, and mm-hmm. that was some years ago.
Gotcha. Now, just a couple years later, you know, you landed in what AMC listed this year as the number 2 most favorite holiday movie behind It's a Wonderful Life, if you can believe that. It's Christmas
Isn't that
Vacation.
Crazy?
How cool is that?
Amazing.
Yeah.
It was amazing, and it was completely unforeseen. I mean, like I said, my agency at the time, we had started to put me on tape and send it on out. But that was exciting just to know that in itself, to know that someone in Los Angeles, someone in Hollywood was watching my tape, was watching my audition right. tape. And so the expectations were low. And on that, when I booked the role on Christmas Vacation, I was still living in Chicago. And
oh, okay.
It was that simple situation. They sent in a tape and that I had made, and casting liked it, and they flew me out to Los Angeles, and I read with Chevy Chase and Jeremiah Chechik, the director, and Chevy gave me the role that day. It was really just
wow.
a kind of whirlwind dream come true experience.
I spoke to Beverly D'Angelo before the holidays because it was the 20th anniversary.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, this year. And she was blown away because she said, wait a minute, this beat out White Christmas and in Miracle on 34th Street? I feel a little sad for America if they put it number 2. But it's a funny, I mean, I got to tell you something. My kids, I guess, you know, my kids are younger. They're 13 and 9 and 2. So the older ones, they want to see Elf and they want to see Christmas Vacation at this age and Christmas
Story.
Sure,
I'm sure it's much more relatable to them than those older films of different generations. It doesn't take away from how brilliant those films are by any means.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that they can just be, might be a bit more, not to take away from Vacation either.
Yeah.
But it's probably just a bit more relatable to a massive audience right now.
Yeah. All right. More with Johnny Galecki from The Big Bang Theory next on 720 WGN.
Oh, look, honey, our kids are necking.
So, did you guys talk about it?
Yeah, it's cool.
Thank you, Mr. Connor.
All right, well, I guess I'll show you your room in the basement.
I don't think so. First of all, there will be no holding hands. There will be no looks across the room. There will be no touchy-feely. There will be no hanky-panky. There will be no smoochy-woochy. And there will be none of that other stuff you're not supposed to know about.
Can we still date?
If you want, but I don't see much point.
And David, while you live here, you'll be home by curfew. You will keep your room clean. You will be the child we've never had.
Okay, that's fair.
These are just the rules today. We reserve the right to change the rules at any time. For your safety, for your education, or for our amusement.
Making us stronger. We're gonna last longer than the greatest wall in China. Oh, that rabbit with a drum. If there's one thing that I've learned while waiting for my turn, it's that
Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're talking to Johnny Galecki, star of the number one sitcom in America, The Big Bang Theory on CBS. You joined Roseanne in the fourth season, and I would imagine Roseanne was very involved in the audition process because she cast you, you know, in the role of David as Sarah Gilbert's character and Darlene's mm-hmm. love interest. That must have been an amazing experience.
Yeah, you know, I didn't audition for that. That wasn't a role that Rose or the writers had written, and then they did the kind of traditional orthodox process of reading actors. I had done a television movie with Roseanne called Backfield in Motion. It was only our best work, the two of us. But we hit it off. We played mother and son, and she asked me to come on and do one episode of Roseanne. I had 3 lines on it and the credit tag, and then she asked me to do 3 more episodes, and then she asked me to do 3 years, and it turned into almost 100 episodes.
But even back then, your timing, your comedic timing, and I know you do dramatic stuff as well, but I mean, your comedic timing at that age was very entertaining. I mean, it was always funny to watch your character on that show.
Well, thank you. I mean, you're right. I didn't go to school for it, and I didn't really. In fact, a lot of people at that time suggested to my parents and myself that they not send to any sort of classes, because whatever was happening, you know, was happening. There wasn't a problem at hand, so there wasn't anything to fix, which was, I've always said that I consider myself comedic actor. It's funny now, I've done so much comedy. I've been so fortunate to do so many comedic projects that people come up to me on the street and ask what comedy club I started in. And I said, oh my God, no, I can't imagine. That's a whole different sport. But I would never ever.
But what a compliment. What a compliment, though, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. But it's just funny to me. I mean, I've always felt that, you know, that if it's funny on the page, then you play the honesty of it.
Yeah.
And if there was some unique timing that I had at that age, I think it was really just natural. I mean, I hadn't really come from, you know, my influences were very different than other kids. My influences were not sports figures or even the other kids in the schoolyard. It might be, you know, a year or two older than them. They were always the guys in the chorus line I was working with at 7 years old.
Sure.
Or, you know, the actors I had watched and performed scenes with, or the other, at that point, the comic actors, and some of them legendary, and Chevy Chase and Rick Clayde. And so, I mean, that was just kind of in me in some sort of, those were my heroes.
Yeah.
Of course, I wanted to emulate them.
Well, you had
but
a great.
I don't know how, I don't know how designed it was as an artist at 10, 11, 12, 13 years old.
That makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. And you talk about legends that you work with. I have also heard you talk about a story about being with Milton Berle, and he was teaching you how to make out. Explain that, would you please?
Yeah, he had a lot of advice.
Yeah, I'm sure he did.
Which is basically kind of perform an upside down triangle with your eyes. Look them in the eye, the mouth, the eye, the eye, the mouth. And next thing you know, you're making out. He wasn't wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
I've put it into practice. He was a very smart man.
And he was on Roseanne?
Very productive man. He was. I think he may have even done more than one episode. I'm not sure. And he actually did an episode in drag, which, you know, for decades he had refused to do because it become such a legendary bit that he had done, especially when he did it. It was so, it really pushed the boundaries. But he did. He did it for Roseanne, which was, I can't imagine how flattered Rose was for that.
And you've done countless movies and TV appearances. And in 2007, you know, not a lot of people can say they have been on two hit television series. And you became the star of one of TV's most successful sitcoms on the Big Bang Theory. And what originally attracted you to the role to do another sitcom?
Honestly, it was the idea that the character would be struggling with love. You know, I haven't gotten many of those roles, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. You know, I've played the love interest best friend or a gay assistant or something like that.
Right, so right, yeah.
It was uncharted territory for me to be given that opportunity. And that's why initially, before they had more than a scene or two written, the producers talked to me about doing the role of Sheldon. I said, you know, I'm kind of much more attracted to this role for this reason. And I'm not saying that, you know, at that time, I certainly didn't know that the Leonard and Penny characters would be successful in the ways of love. But I knew that that's what that character would be struggling with.
But
and
you
that really attracted to it to me. When you think that way, you have to think best and worst case scenario. You know, you could be doing this for a number of years playing this role, and it's going to need to be something that is going to be fun and interesting and challenging.
I was
going to
say, as an actor,
every week for what could be a decade of your life.
That's what I have to think. Yeah, that's what I have to think. Is that, you know, as an actor, you want something
being
that's
not self-protective. Yeah. I mean, the chances are that you're not going to be. But I knew that was the case. Then And that would have me galvanized every week to do the best job, to give it 110% every day.
It is a funny, funny show, and it's in its eighth season. The audience continues to grow, 18 million plus viewers per week, and the writing is consistently good, and that is also rare, especially for a series in its eighth season. I only feel like it's in the beginning. Like I don't feel like this is like, oh, they're in their eighth season already. It's hot in syndication, and I was looking at this too. Number one comedy on all of cable. It's even on the reruns when you're on like TBS, this show does better than some of the first run stuff, not only on cable, but on broadcast television. That's pretty incredible.
It is. And I mean, all I do is just kind of pinch myself and, right, and be grateful and be in awe of that because, you know, like I said, it's nothing that anyone could predict or design. Yeah. And there's no recipe for it. I mean, even as successful as Chuck Lorre is, I think he's just as thrilled and humbled by it as anyone else. You know what you think is funny and appealing, and you love your characters, and sure, and you hope that people outside the soundstage feel the same way.
Yeah, well, I like that the show it takes its time with the characters. You know, still this day, it's still like developing. You're learning more and more about these characters. It's not the same dimensional character that you started with. It's always evolving, it seems like.
Well, that was by design, and I give Chuck a lot of credit for that, especially in the first season or two. You know, you're given a character that you're excited about. You want to take that ball and you want to run with it. You want to run. You want to make a touchdown. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
As a selfish actor, you want to do all you can with it. And he kind of calmed us down and early on and said, you know, these guys evolve at a very, very slow pace.
Yeah,
there's
yeah,
a lot of two steps forward, one, two, sometimes three steps back. And that's okay because we hope to be here for a long time and there's going to be a lot of hard-learned lessons for them.
Well, I think
they don't necessarily process things in the way that you hope for your character mm-hmm. to get to another level so that you can create a growth. Then there were certain things that would have been irresponsible to not change your character. When, you know, when Penny broke Leonard's heart, that was something right. I knew. That changes you. You
sure.
know, that really, you're not the same person ever again when something like that happens. So that evolved the character, and we tried to be responsible towards that.
Well, I think those life experiences is what everybody relates to, as you said, and it's also, you know, I'm in my 40s. I still feel like I'm growing up, and I might feel that way for another 20, 30 years, but that's what the show kind of is all about. It's about growing up and hitting those life
challenges.
Don't you
kind of hope you always feel that way?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think there's a feeling, and I don't know if it's specific to the West, that once you're done with your formal education, then you kind of have all you need on the hard drive for the rest of
yeah.
life.
Yeah.
And I don't think that I find that to be a very boring. I would feel very stagnant, frustrated if that was the case.
Yeah, agree with you.
In my own life.
Yeah, no, I agree. I absolutely agree. The show will wrap production in a month or two. What are your plans to take some time off, you know, for the summer? Do you do some theater? Do you just chill? What's on deck for you?
I'm a workhorse, man. I'm the happiest when working. I always have been. So I like the idea of taking some time off.
Yeah.
But my idea of time, the perfect duration of time off for me is a 3-day weekend. Any more than that, I start to get a bit antsy.
Gotcha. So you'll have some stuff to keep you busy. And hopefully you'll be back here in Chicago
yeah.
and enjoying the beautiful weather.
I'll definitely take some time to do that, yeah.
Cool.
Down on Marchie and Greco.
Cool, yeah. Your buddy Marchie and Greco. I'm going to let him know. that is very funny. The Big
yeah,
Bang.
Warn him.
I will warn him. I will do that. Big Bang Theory airs every Thursday at 7 Central on CBS. Still number one in his game. Johnny, absolute pleasure spending some time with us tonight. I appreciate it.
Take care, dude.
All right. Much more ahead on 720 WGN.
Every mind on the run, and a delicate look in her eyes.
It's Dave Plyer and Wendy Snyder hanging out with us tonight on 720 WGN. So born Declan Patrick McManus, Elvis Costello was raised in London and Liverpool, grandson of a trumpet player on the White Star Line, and son of a jazz musician who became a successful radio dance band vocalist. And Costello went on to the family business, and before he was 24, took the popular music world by storm. Now, Elvis continues to add one of the most intriguing and extensive songbooks of our day, and his brand new book, Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink, describes how his career has endured for almost four decades. The new book offers his unique view on his unlikely and sometimes comical rise to international success with diversions through the previously undocumented emotional foundations of some of his best-known songs and the hits of tomorrow. Now, he recounts collaborations with George Jones, Chet Baker, T-Bone Burnett, writing songs with Paul McCartney, The Roots. He shares curious experiences in the company of The Clash, Tony Bennett, The Specials, Van Morrison, Aretha Franklin, to name just a few. Now, he's won countless of awards in his career, including a Grammy, his induction to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Rolling Stone has ranked him on the list of the 100 greatest artists of all time, and he does some amazing work on behalf of the Jazz Foundation of America as well. And live in studio, Elvis Costello is joining us tonight. Elvis, welcome back to Chicago.
My goodness me.
Are we out of time?
I feel, yeah. I feel like any moment the Vatican is going to be on the phone. You know, like,
good God, Dave, you asked me to sit in here because I'm a huge Elvis Costello fan, but we have no time left after that intro.
I'm reading the CV.
Well, there's a lot to talk about. There's a lot.
Very kind of you to mention all of that.
Absolutely. So I have to start with your recent appearance on Stephen Colbert, where they showed a clip of your dad performing on television, spitting image, obviously. Your look, his look.
I am of him.
Exactly. The glasses, the shoes. And you talk about in the book, at such a young age, you know, you use some of his recording equipment as well. It's kind of a like father, like son thing, isn't it?
Well, I suppose it might appear that way. Certainly when my folks were together, my dad was in the front room learning songs that you know, I might have otherwise been told to turn down on my record player in my bedroom, you know?
Yeah.
I was 10 years old when I started paying attention to the music that he was learning weekly. He sang with the Radio Dance Band, as you say. And that particular little clip was a short film that the orchestra he sang with made to commemorate the fact that they just played the very prestigious Royal Command performance alongside the Beatles that year. The Beatles were on it. It's the occasion where John Lennon famously said, well, you can clap along and the rest of you can rattle your jewellery. And that, of course, in those days, people didn't say that kind of cheeky stuff in front of the Queen Mother. So I had this exciting moment of watching my dad on the bill with my, you know, at the time, my favorite group.
That's pretty cool.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah,
and
so.
The Beatles came back to kind of inspire you. A song that was playing that your dad was learning by the Beatles?
Well, yeah. I don't know what he did with all the records he brought home every night, every week, I should say. On this occasion, I was just moved to go in and ask him, what are you doing with that record when you finished with it? Could I have it? And it was Please Please Me, and the rest is misery.
And he was learning that for a performance.
Yeah, he would learn a big stack of records every week because that's the way music was heard in England. It was filtered through all the radio dance bands and palm court orchestras and the cinema organ. We didn't have hours and hours of pop radio. We just didn't. It was the way it was set up. It was because of the agreements with the Musicians Union and the Performing Rights Societies. They were only allowed to play 5 hours of all the recorded music per day.
Wow.
Which meant that a lot of work for you know, working musicians, which was a good thing, kept us in beans and you know, brown ale. But it meant that the versions of the songs that we were familiar with first were often a bit bizarre. You know, they got used to it because that was what they were familiar with. But it was, I think there was a bit of tension between that and the groups of the day who also had to queue up to make guest appearances so their song could be heard. So they would come on these radio shows and play live. And that's how I got to see the Hollies up close when I was 10 years old.
Wow.
You know,
wow.
Right?
Wow.
But I also got to see them set up. There was some magic to that transformation from a bunch of scruffy lads who walked in carrying their own amplifiers to a group that, and this was a lunchtime radio show, so they would have to somehow spruce themselves up and come out wearing their shiny suits. And
this is at a very young age. I mean, you're being influenced by all of this.
Yeah, about 10.
Yeah. Well, first of all, terrific book. This is like a 10-pounder. This is
it is 600 and some pages, and I didn't
have
time.
That's the way I asked. I was told that you were paid by weight.
That was
well,
very
kudos
smart.
To you. I didn't have a chance to read this, but I'm so excited to have it. Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink. You're such a lyricist. Everything you say is magical.
Well, thank you.
Well, I mean, you know, your family history, career highs and lows, life experiences. Is it true that you really never kept diaries or notes, really? This is all kind of from the top of your head.
I have a very, very good memory. I'm lucky, and I suppose the disappearing ink part of it is acknowledging the fact that may not always be the case. You know, my dad wasn't lucky enough to keep his memory to the end of his life, his mother before him. You better maybe choose your time when you've done, and there's enough time gone by that you can look back at things clearly and see the value of some of the things. I mean, the book isn't told guided by the calendar. It's if you're looking for
right.
I was born
no,
and then I did
like
this
that.
In all this order, it's not in chronological order. It's in emotional order. It's how these things and the sensations of hearing music and the understanding and the use I made of it later. If that's what you're curious about, then this is the book for you.
Yeah, definitely. And your dad might
otherwise
have not
read Wikipedia.
Yeah, right,
which
exactly.
is always wrong, by the way. Have you checked your Wikipedia page?
Yeah.
I don't know how that works.
Anyone could get on and edit it. Every time
I'm thinking then of putting a bunch of other stuff on there.
You should.
I was an Olympic gymnast or something like that.
That would be perfect.
Yeah.
And then
anybody
some radio
looking at me would guess that.
Some guy would be asking
some
that
radio
question.
DJ would
That's
be
true.
Like, so what is your specialty in
That's
the
true.
End?
That's true.
It's the horse.
Nice.
Handles nice. Or no handles?
No handles.
Okay, you're good.
Yeah. Right in the beginning of the book, chapter 6, you share the fact, you know, and very witty. I mean, it's just the book is entertaining and funny throughout the whole book as well. I was born in the same hospital in which Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin. I apologize in advance that I have not been the same boon to mankind. I think you did pretty well for yourself.
Not as well as penicillin.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. That's true.
No, but I mean, that's where you would normally start a book, and that's why I made a joke based on the what would be the normal opening line of conventional biography, because then I you know, in each chapter, I try to find a way to open up with some sort of anecdote or reflection and let my experiences take me wherever they would. I mean, it's not random. There was a beautifully detailed master plan, you know, like a blueprint, like you would have for a building. No, that's a lie.
I was going to say, wow. It was very
no, but I almost had you going there.
You did. You
no,
did.
No, but I mean, I discovered the structure that once, as yeah. you write for a while, and obviously I did work on this for a while, you discover that you have worked towards a structure that is satisfying to you. And, you know, somebody else has, I'm sure, written a book in a more, to them, logical order. To me, tedious. And I just didn't feel it that way. And that's my responsibility, is to tell the tale as I feel it, more than it just be a bunch of facts, you know.
But you talk a lot through the whole book, really, about your dad and kind of what an influence he was in different stages of your life. And your grandfather was also a musician. Comes in the whole family.
My grandfather got out of a couple of institutions playing the trumpet. You know, mm-hmm. firstly an orphanage and then the British Army. I mean, the British Army taught him how to play the trumpet, then sent him to France where he got shot, you know, which is not really what you plan for a trumpet player. He was fortunate to survive. He was missing. And, you know, I think probably then thought, well, maybe I should get a job that's a little less dangerous, and worked on the White Star Line and traveled to America, which was a very exciting prospect sure. for a man of his background. And came to America in the 1920s, which must have been a great time to come, even for a ship's musician.
Sure.
And I've got pictures that both of him evidently enjoying himself.
That's cool.
And sort of things that took his eye. So that's all part of the story, because we all think we invented the mischief of life. Everybody thinks they invented sex. You know, of course, your grandparents, you wouldn't be here unless your grandparents also knew about it. You know,
and
so
parents,
to know that he
yeah.
was a man alive in the world and got to go to America and saw some of that life, it was intriguing to me, because it's something that drove my dad to leave home to play music, something that drove me to leave home, maybe in a different way, and play music. So, you know, that's another way of telling the tale of how I got here.
What about the Record King of America? Anything about your grandfather represented there?
Well, in the song "American Without Tears," yes. he's mentioned. Yeah, in the lyrics, because at that time in my life, I felt like I was running away from something myself, and made the comparison with a choice that he made to leave to go to America. I was sort of willfully going there. You know, he pops up in a few of my songs. In fact, I've always found some inspiration in talking about my family in the lyrics of songs without necessarily making it a sentimental case. I mean, a well-known song of mine, Veronica, is about my grandmother's drift into Alzheimer's. But, you know, when I was given the opportunity to write that song with Paul McCartney, my impulse was to write a bright, hopeful-sounding song, not a melancholy, mournful song about something you might commonly accompany in that way. And that's something I've discovered over the years. It sometimes works well to my advantage that I take the music and contrast it with the seriousness of the lyric. Otherwise, you're sort of advertising in advance the
meaning.
The meaning, yeah. and the emotional sense. So you can get a little tension playing one against the other.
Dave, one more question, then I'll let you do some interviewing.
So it's all good.
She just wandered in.
It's all good.
We don't actually know who she is.
But so on King of America, are you tributed, it says Elvis Costello, or TLH, is that two left hands because you claim to not be a good guitarist?
No, it's a nickname that Nick Lowe, my producer, gave me back in the beginning of my career because I could smash at least four strings off my guitar if I got carried away singing. So he called me the flamenco guitar players would always have very elaborate names, legends after their name, like the, you know, Hands of Quicksilver or something. And so he said I was the Little Hands of Concrete.
Little Hands of Concrete.
The Little Hands of Concrete, yeah.
Now, you talk about the meaning behind some of your songs and not actually throwing it out there, but it's just part of the fabric of what you write. There's a chapter in the book called Unfaithful Music it's about the song Allison. Mm. You give away a little bit. You know, I believe that Allison was a work of fiction, taking the sad face of a beautiful girl glimpsed by chance and imagining her life unraveled before her. It was a premonition, my fear that I would not be faithful or my disbelief in happy endings would lead me to kill the love that I had longed for. So you have said that the sad face of this beautiful girl was somebody you saw.
Somebody I glimpsed by chance, but it put in focus a feeling I had about myself. And it is a strange experience to write songs that other people see themselves in and know that it's something about yourself. I mean, I didn't advertise the nature of that song when it was first issued. This is something that I've come to accept was there. Where I've mentioned it in the case of several songs. Some songs are sort of premonitions. Maybe because you're writing them as songs, they dig out parts of your own psyche or your own nature or soul or whatever word you want to use to describe it. I've never really thought of it as that kind of divinity. But
do you know how many girls wish their name was Allison when you sang that?
I beg your pardon?
Do you know how many girls wish their name was Allison?
Well,
I
think there's also probably just as many of being sick of people singing it to them because they they know somebody annoying who heard it once. You know, I think there's actually both. And that's what I know to be true because people have told me. But no, of course, it's always... I would have written more songs of girls' names if I'd known how popular they were going to be.
You talk a little bit about
I always thought Agnes is a name.
Agnes was one of them?
Nobody's really sung any songs called Agnes or... Some of the less, you know...
Attractive.
But they're beautiful. If you know a beautiful Mildred or, you know... There was a Mildred in the movies.
Sure.
Yeah, Mildred Pierce.
Mildred Pierce.
Some names that have gone out of fashion. I think we should. Maybe I'll do a whole album of songs that names that have gone out of fashion.
That would be fabulous. Yeah. Let's throw Albert, Clara, Elga.
Albert, yeah,
exactly.
Albert. Yeah. Percy. Sorry if there's any Percys on this station.
All right. I don't believe there is.
No.
Overnights, maybe.
Horace.
On Sunday.
How about Horace?
Horace would be good.
Boy, you're picking some doozy names there. I can't wait for the album. What's in a name?
You talked a lot in the book, too, about, you know, defining yourself as a performer, and you kind of got cast as, like, the angry guy a little bit throughout your career.
I love the way you did that with your hands when you said the angry guy.
The
angry guy. Yeah, because that obviously wasn't all it was about. And you would just have to listen to listen really to the songs, not just to the first impression of them. I think even the first couple of records to know there was conflict there was emphatic things said, some things that were, I suppose, aggressive. Also some regret and tenderness in songs like Allison. So
sure.
It would be a simplification. And I always thought it was, as I was saying it, I thought, well, of course you know there's more to it than that. That's why I'm saying this.
Yeah.
Because I know you're going to challenge it. And a lot of people just wrote it down and then it became like, you know, my business card for a while.
Sure.
But I got over that.
After SNL.
Some other people didn't get over it so well. You know, I got over it a long time ago, and that's what I've been working at, is doing all these other songs ever since.
Well, speaking of SNL.
Yeah, and you got over it after the SNL appearance.
Yeah, the SNL thing, I think, is all... It's very much more talked about in America because people, including ourselves, didn't know what SNL was. That's one of the reasons that we perhaps ran into that problem there, because we were told the show was like Monty Python.
Yeah,
because I suppose they were sort of looking for an, you know, it's the alternative to more mainstream comedy. That's all they meant by saying that. Bear in mind that we'd only been in the country 2 or 3 weeks, and every Saturday night we've been working, so we'd had no opportunity to see the show. And the scrap that I was having was not so much with the show in any case. It was the record company wanting us to sing a specific song, me thinking that song isn't really going to mean anything to people in America. I want to sing this then newly completed song. Radio. And, hey, live was in the name of the show.
You right.
It seemed like a pretty good guess
that
we could do that.
Absolutely.
You know? But, and the strange thing about it is that you have to remember there were no video recorders to speak of back then. So anybody that tells you they saw it after the fact is not telling the truth. They're remembering the little bit of reportage.
A little bit of a wise tale.
At the time. And of course, later it was repeated, and then once people started doing, you know, like when Sinead O'Connor tore up the picture of the Pope, somehow I got the blame. And Ashley Simpson caught lip-syncing, somehow I got the blame. It's been nice of them to keep blaming me for that. But of course, I was back on NBC within 3 years.
I was going to say it was a short-term ban.
I didn't do SNL for 12 years, but maybe I wouldn't have been on it anyway. It's not your turn to be on every show. You know, it's like...
Sure.
I mean, all those shows are like a ride at the fun fair. You have to get the back of the queue if you want to go on it again.
True.
Yeah. And when you sat in for David Letterman, you were brilliant as an interviewer.
Thank you. I enjoyed doing that. I mean, David was, his producers were always very welcoming. I was on the show about 29 times as a music guest, maybe 30, I don't know, with all sorts of configurations. I played solo, I played with the Attractions, I played with the Imposters, I played with Burt Bacharach, and I played with some of my friends, you know, from other fields of music, the Fairfield Four, the Gospel Quartet, and myself, and the Jazz Passengers.
And played with Paul, of course.
Yeah, and they let me play with all these people on the show. So when it came time to host, it was, you know, it was good fun to do that for one evening. I don't know that I would want to be doing that every night.
But you hosted your own show for a little while.
Different sort of form. You know, Spectacle was a show we did for Sundance Channel and CTV up in Canada. And it was... It was conversation and music, so I was trusted by my victims to come in, and they share the stage willingly. But we share the similar job in the sense that we go onto the stage with words and music at our disposal and try to tell some sort of story. So whether it be Renee Fleming, the opera singer, or Lou Reed, very different sound of music, but still it's the same proposition. So there was always something in common, and it seemed to allow them to trust me. And we got to do I got to sing with some people that I never imagined I'd ever sing with, like Smokey Robinson.
Well, in depth to these conversations, too. I saw a lot of them on YouTube. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, because it wasn't sound bites. We were able to talk it, you know, full sentences, and they were able to illustrate. People were very generous with their time. Bruce Springsteen did, I think we must have been in the Apollo Theater for 4 hours, you know. So a short night for Bruce. You know?
Yeah.
That would be a short night for him. All these stories, I mean, and we just touched the surface, are in Elvis's new book. It's called Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink, and you can pick that up at Amazon or wherever books are sold. And for more on anything Elvis Costello, visit elviscostello.com. Great having you in studio with One
Thank
Day
you.
And I tonight.
And
Thank you
also,
so much.
May I say, it's great if people go and get it delivered to their house, but go to your local bookshop.
Go to that
place where the people really think about books. Go to the shop that you love and buy the books that you love. I have a strong feeling. I think it's great that the big bookstores there have all the stock that they can afford to carry everything. But you know, there's a bookstore everybody knows in one neighborhood or another where there are people who really have thought about the books they put on display, and I appreciate, you know, their care.
And supporting
the
local
business.
In the same
way as it's always been for me, the record shops were like that. That's how I learned the music. that I learned. All I knew were just one or two songs that came out of America on compilation albums. I'd come and find
in the music stores
whole big sort of racks full of, whether they were brand new records or secondhand records or pawn shop records. Wherever you get it,
sure.
Yeah, but I appreciate that.
Thank you, Elvis.
Thank you very much.
All right, when can I do my interview with him?
right after this.
Are we doing it now?
720 WGN.
Jackie Gleason. The Honeymooners. With the stars Art Carney, Audrey Meadows, and Joyce Randolph.
Welcome back, everybody. It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. So the original 39 episodes of classic Emmy Award-winning television series The Honeymooners turns 60 years old. Originally a recurring sketch on Jackie Gleason's live variety show, The Honeymooners aired as film productions in 1955 and 56. And while only 39 episodes were shot, the characters were brought back for Gleason's 60s variety show, making a run on American television screens through the 1970s and to this day, continuing in syndication, all with the stars Jackie Gleason, Art Carney, Audrey Meadows, and our guest, who played the wife of Ralph's best friend, Norton, Trixie Norton. Ladies and gentlemen, the one and only Joyce Randolph. Joyce, welcome to the program.
Hello, dear. How nice to be here with you.
Oh, we are so excited to have you on the program. I can't express how excited I am to have the opportunity to spend some time with you. You are a television legend who was on one of the most successful sitcoms in the history of the medium.
Well, that's what they say, and we did it.
You did do it. You are a Midwest girl. You grew up in Detroit.
In Detroit, yes.
Yeah. You dipped into acting in school. I know you were in school plays, many as the lead.
Oh, yes.
You
had to do that.
You had to do that. That's how you got started. And, at a pretty young age, you knew you wanted to be an actress.
I have recently had a letter from a lady who knew my grandmother way up in northern Michigan. And she said that when we were all visiting there one summer, and she talked to me and that I was very young, and I said, I'm going to be an actress. Now, I don't remember that at all, but she tells me this, so maybe it's true.
Maybe it is true. Well, not only that, but I think you knew also at some point you wanted to also be in New York.
Yes, I knew that I couldn't do this in Detroit. I had to be in New York.
Now, second or third grade, you performed as Mother Goose. All right, so that was your debut role right there. You grew up with the movies, but you also grew up with radio. What were some of the movies and radio programs back in the day that influenced you back then that said, boy, these are really great shows. I want to be a part of this.
Oh, dear. I don't know. On the radio? Well, we listened to things on the radio, of course. But never thought of being a radio actress, though. No, I just always knew it had to be stage. I love the movies, went to the movies a lot. Even now I look at Turner Classic Movies, I look at all the old movies. Sure. I don't know, I just love all the old stars and the old movies, and I don't care for today's new movies.
I hear you. There's the movies that were made way back when in the 30s, the 40s, and 50s, there are classics that can never be remade. I mean, they try to sometimes, but some of these with the classic actors, the writing, the directing is pretty incredible to watch even today.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. At 16, you went to the Expression School of Speech and Drama in Detroit. Now, that was a school outside of high school, correct?
Yes. I think it was Tuesday nights and Friday nights. Mm-hmm. And I would travel all the way downtown on the bus, and it made my parents nervous, but I just had to do this,
Sure. Were your parents pretty supportive of you wanting to do this and take on this?
My mother was, but my father didn't care for it, no.
Yeah. Yeah, some people, they say, this business, which is totally true, you take a chance getting into it to begin with. And especially when you get started, you got to take on other jobs. I believe you auditioned for the Wayne Civic Workshop in Detroit, which was a prestigious group of dramatic actors and actresses at the time.
Yes, and they took me in as their youngest member. Mm-hmm.
And there was a production of Stage Door that came to Detroit. You got a part, and that was a big deal. That was really your first major.
Yes, it was a wonderful break, and that came through the Catholic Actors Guild in Detroit. That was the other big group. But the head of that group had seen me in, The Voice of the Importance of Being Earnest. And he had said he had seen me in that, so would I go in with his girls from the Catholic Theater and audition for Stage Door when Arthur Jarrett came to town. And I did that, and I was cast as the Boston Society girl, and then we went into rehearsal when the rest of the cast got here from New York. You know, the producers couldn't afford to hire all those young actresses and send them to Detroit from New York, so they hired Detroit girls, and we were just fine.
Which made sense, but that also put you on the road, too. You did 6 weeks in Detroit doing Stage Door, and then you went on tour. And
well,
did
yes, it was so successful that they decided to go to Chicago.
Here.
The Chicago critics are a little... or maybe much more critical than the Detroit ones, and we really just had 2 weeks there. And so we went back to Detroit, and one of the other girls, Marie, what the hell was her name, Marie Fritzley, and I told our parents, we're going to New York. And the character man in the show, Bobby Bernard, he was a sweet man. He had a sister in Detroit. He says, I'll go back to Detroit, see my sister for a few days. You two girls tell your parents you're going to New York. He said, I will escort you. And he did. He was just darling. He escorted us on the overnight train, sitting up. We got to New York, and there it was, in all its glory.
Wow. Yeah, the trains back then, too. Yeah, you're right. There was no really, sleeping cars at the time that were cost-effective. So, I mean, you were pretty much sitting up the entire time.
I think it was 1875 for the tickets.
Oh, is that right? That's awesome. That's awesome. Now, that was in 1943. When you got to New York, what was your first big break?
I learned to make rounds through other girls, and it was just a few weeks later, I was walking down 44th Street or whatever and ran into Mr. McCoy, who had produced Stage Door. And he said, hey, kid, you want to go back to Detroit? And I said, oh, what do you mean, Mr. McCoy? He said, I'm sending out a touring revival of AB's Irish Rose, and you can be the understudy to Rosemary, and you have to help the stage manager. And in the wedding scene, you have to be the matron of honor. And in every city, we'll find three other girls to be bridesmaids. And you have to teach the bridesmaids what to do in each city. And all of this for a very small amount of money. But it didn't matter. I think I got my card. No, I already had my card. But, I got a job. So that was great. And I went on tour with that for a whole year.
And you did that as well. And then when you were back in New York, and you did a lot of touring around the country at that time, but
yeah, there was more of that going on.
Mm-hmm. But you did make ends meet. I mean, you did what every actress does, Broadway actress does, and make ends. You worked at Saks Fifth Avenue, I think, for a little while.
No, it wasn't that glamorous. It was another store. I can't think of Learners. I think
it was
Learners.
It was Learners. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So it was the Learners. Now you got to work when you were on stage with some of the greats. You worked with Gloria Swanson. Tell me what that was like.
Oh, that was wild.
I bet.
She was very nervous, to be on Broadway. She was a huge motion picture star,
right.
But she wasn't that known on Broadway. And, everybody knew her, but, she was very nervous. And the show was very good. It was called, what was it called? A Goose for the Gander.
Okay.
Very cute play written by Harold J. Kennedy. Also directed by Harold, and he played one of the leads, which was probably a bit of a mistake because the critics were just waiting for him. He had not been a popular man in New York City, and they really ripped the play apart because of Harold J. Kennedy. It was really a very cute show. It went on for years in summer stock with various leading ladies, elderly, not elderly, but, over the hump leading ladies, taking it on tour in summer stock, did very well. But he killed us on, the critics killed us on Broadway, which was too bad.
Now, but you did.
She was okay. She was very nervous and not overly friendly. And I played the maid, and she said, that girl is too young, put glasses on her or something.
to make you look older. That's nice. That's nice. Because you do hear, back in the day, there were some stars out there that wanted you to shine, and they wanted to see, you know, they were just as much as interested in the people around them than themselves. And then there was people like Gloria Swanson, who was kind of in it for herself.
Yeah, she was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Now, at that point, you went out to Hollywood in 1946, 1947.
1946, 1947. I guess I was out there 14 months. I did not like it that much.
Yeah.
And I said, got to get back to New York, back into television.
Well, there's something.
I had already done a little television, you know, before then.
Yeah, you wanted to move back because, I mean, there's a sense of reality in New York. There's nothing like the stage and the Broadway scene in New York, and things are just run a little differently. It was a little too glamorous, a little bit over the top in L.A. Now, you did, as you mentioned, many early television shows. There was a drama you did, I think, for General Electric. It was on WRGB. That was one of your first shows that you did.
Was that summer? What the heck was the name of that? Yes.
Yeah, you did a lot of drama back then, but you also did a lot of detective shows, and there was a lot of...
Yes, there were so many of them at the time, and I was always doing famous jury trials and Martin Caine, and you did all those detective shows. It was wonderful, yeah.
Well, we are talking to a television legend, Joyce Randolph, the only surviving cast member of classic television series The Honeymooners, and when we come back, we'll talk about how she landed the role of Trixie, life on the set, and so much more. Next on 720 WGN.
Hey, Ralph?
What?
Mind if I smoke?
I don't care if you burn.
It's Dave Player on 720 WGN. We're talking to Joyce Randolph, who played Trixie on one of the most classic television series of all time, The Honeymooners. Coming from such a rich theater experience, it must have been familiar territory when you did live television in the early 1950s.
Yes, it wasn't too hard to do that. It was easy. I thought, you know, you'd change clothes behind the set because you only had about a minute.
Right.
And you didn't care who saw anything. And it was very hectic, but very good. And we loved it.
Yeah, you know, but at that time, because television was so new, people from the movies, people from the stage didn't look, you know, a lot of people didn't look up to television. They looked at it as like a step down. But those who embraced it really went somewhere with it.
Yeah, that's true, but it was looked down upon. You're right. Mm-hmm.
Now, how would you describe live television at the time when you were doing these shows? What was the experience like? It must have felt like Broadway, but, I mean, I would think there was a lot of chaos and running around because it was a new medium to begin with. And then
it was all new, and it was different from the stage, and we sort of loved being in something new. Yeah, there was some very experimental stuff very early on. I think General Motors did it, or General Electric, and you had to wear, like, blue lipstick, and the lights were so bright, it was terrible. And then the lights got better, and you didn't have to wear blue lipstick, but it was fun to do that very early stuff.
You know, it's funny, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, but, you know, Studio 50, which is the Ed Sullivan Theater where Letterman did his shows, you know, he kept the air conditioning blowing pretty cold because the lights get so hot. Especially,
he wanted it cold, I guess.
Yeah, in these older studios, so that's something for that. Now, you were on the Colgate Comedy Hour, then in 1951, you did a Clorets commercial, which you almost didn't get because you were too tall for the person that was playing opposite of you, the gentleman that was playing opposite of you, so you wore flats.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
To do the spot, but you got it. And the Clorets commercial was a big deal for many reasons, but it got you discovered by the great Jackie Gleason. Tell me a little bit about how that happened.
Yeah, well, I got the Clorets commercial wearing flats, and then Joe Cates was the casting guy. This was still way back at
Dumont.
Channel 5,
yeah.
Dumont. And he called up and said, we're going to repeat that Clorets commercial, so come in again. And I did, and we repeated it. And then a few weeks later, Joe Cates is on the phone again, and he said, could you come in and audition and try to look older? He said, Jackie has written a strange little skit with the writers. Jackie mostly wrote it, and he's going to audition a few women, so you come in too. And I did, and Jackie asked me to do it. I guess I did it, and you know, with like one rehearsal, thank God I was able to do that with one rehearsal. And he evidently liked it, and it just sat there that night on television. Nobody knew what this was, with this strange little skit with excuse me, Gleason playing a sort of old vaudevillian who came back to his hometown and talked to the woman he should have married long ago, which was me.
Okay.
And then a few weeks later, Joe Cates called up and he said, "Oh, have you seen this thing we've been doing? Excuse me, called The Honeymooners." And I said, "No, my roommate Diana and I, we don't even have a television set."
Yeah, you worked on television, early television, but you never saw yourself really on
no.
television. Yeah, it's funny. That's how it was back then.
So he said, "Well, you know, it's Art Carney is the sewer worker, but Jackie Gleason is the bus driver, and at that time, Pert Kelton was Alice, the wife." And he said, "Jackie said, get me that serious actress for Trixie." That's all he knew. Serious actress, didn't know my name or anything, but he put me in it that way. It's not good to fall into something that way. I mean, it's wonderful, yet. You don't have any agent representing you. You never get any money.
Right. And this was, by the way, this was on the DuMont Television Network on the Cavalcade of Stars at one point.
Yes, that's what it was. It was on Jackie Gleason's Cavalcade of Stars. Mm-hmm.
From your perspective, tell us about the role of Trixie. What did they want you to do on the onset of these first episodes?
They just gave me the script and you said the words. Nobody told me what to do. You played it the way you wanted to play it. That's all. And it seemed to satisfy them, you know. I was really, in a way, playing myself, which is stupid, but that's the way it was. Yeah. And it worked out okay.
Yeah. Well, and plus it was a story, you know, TV movies always kind of glamorized life quite a bit. And this was... not that. This was the lower side of growing up in New York. How are the Cramdons, okay, different from the Nortons on this show? How did you see them two differently?
Well, they were all very poor in Brooklyn, but Jackie was all Mr. Cramden was always losing money, whereas Art Carney somehow seemed to make money, and our apartment was much better looking than theirs.
Yes, it was.
Everybody commented on, which was really kind of silly that ours could be that much better looking, but it was.
It was comparatively. I mean,
Jackie wanted his to be very plain, very poor looking. Evidently, he had grown up very poor in Brooklyn, and he wanted it that way.
It was a reflection of life.
Yeah.
For him. Yeah. People used to send curtains and other household items to CBS that the Cramdons could have
them to some hospital.
Yeah. Is that what happened? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. With all the items that you sent to them. What was it like? And I know this is a long answer. So what was it like working with Jackie? You know, I know he was in control of everything from what I've heard. He didn't rehearse that much. What was life like working with Jackie Gleason?
Well, a little difficult because he wasn't overly friendly, you know. He could be very nice, but he could also be a little bit mean if he wanted to and give orders. But he wanted things his way, and things were done his way. And he just wasn't going to rehearse much because he said it's not funny if it's over-rehearsed. It's got to be fresh and spontaneous. And he was right. He was right. With us, it worked. So we didn't have long rehearsal schedules at all, like people on the Moses Sid Caesar show over on NBC. We were on CBS. They were NBC. And they worked all week to put their show on. And, you know, our June Taylor dancers worked all week, yes, but the skits didn't. And that's the way it was. That's the way he wanted it. He was slightly a difficult man. Not, you know, I didn't want to be overly friendly with him, so it was fine.
Well, and you know, when we're talking about watching the series today, you can see that there's anticipation from the actors, from all four of you on the set, because there's also a little ad-libbing that goes on in these shows as well.
Yes.
You know, so I could see you're all kind of anticipating, like, okay, what's coming next, and am I going to do my line, or do I need to do something else? You could see it, that it was, like, a live...
Well, I hope we couldn't see it too much.
No, but in a good way. In a good way, yeah.
But Audrey was a brilliant girl. She knew every word in the script. She knew everybody's lines, particularly Jackie's. She knew she had to, you know, and she was wonderful.
Yeah, I was going to say there was a way that Audrey would cue Jackie and others when they're if they missed their cue or missed their line, or she'd look over to an area where, you know, if Jackie was supposed to walk over to the fridge, she'd look over to the fridge to kind of give him a clue of where he was going. Mm-hmm. She kind of was a little bit of an associate director on the set because she had to keep things focused.
Yes.
Yeah. I remember, Joyce, when I was watching Comic Relief. It was about 1990. And it was a few years after Jackie passed already. But they brought you, Audrey Meadows, Art Carney, on stage.
Yes.
And first time that you were really on stage together for maybe 30 years. Mm-hmm. I will tell you the ridiculous excitement I felt seeing all of you up there. That must have been surreal.
It was unbelievable. The three of us started crying. When you walk out on that stage and you see this whole audience get up and applaud, we started to cry. And Art says, oh, you think I was Marlon Brando. I said, you're better.
But you are, you know.
It was quite a night. Oh.
But legends. You are legends. I mean, if you really look at, like, the top shows or early shows of television, you know, again, people talk about Lucy and Dick Van Dyke, but The Honeymooners is right there. I mean, that is one of the most iconic shows of the 20th century.
Yeah, we were right there with Lucille Ball,
Well, the original 39 episodes of The Honeymooners turned 60 this month, and that's absolutely amazing. The complete Honeymooners series and lost episodes, as Joyce mentioned, are all available on DVD, and you can catch The Honeymooners locally and across the country on MeTV. Joyce, honestly, it has been an honor to have you on the program. You are a legend, big part of one of the most successful award-winning legendary series of all time, and I'm so glad you took the time for us tonight.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Sorry, just finishing up my costume.
Who the hell are you supposed to be?
You never saw Pretty in Pink?
Oh, right, you're Molly Ringwald.
I'm Ducky, you know, the best friend, the scene stealer. Some would say the true star of the film.
Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. So you know if it can happen in show business, it's happened to actor John Cryer. Now he's opening up for the first time and sharing his behind-the-scenes story in a warmly endearing, sharply observed, and frankly funny look at life in Hollywood. In 1986, John won over America as Molly Ringwald's loyal and lovable best friend Ducky in the cult classic Pretty in Pink, in a role that set the tone for his three-decade-long career in Hollywood. He went on to establish himself as one of the most talented comedy actors in the business, ultimately starring as Alan Harper in the massively popular sitcom Two and a Half Men with his friend Charlie Sheen and later Ashton Kutcher, which just completed its run after 12 successful years on the air. And joining us tonight to talk about it all in his new book, So That Happened, a memoir, is John himself. John, how are you?
I'm good.
Right.
Sometimes I have to think about it for a couple of minutes.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, you got to feel great because, you know, I find this incredible, a 12-year run on Two and a Half Men, that alone is pretty groundbreaking.
Yeah. At one point, we were having sort of a wrap party for the show, and Peter Roth, who runs Warner Brothers, mentioned that something that I actually did not know, which was that by running 12 years, Two and a Half Men became the longest running multi-camera sitcom in the history of broadcast television.
Yeah.
Which I thought was nuts. I'll take it.
Yeah, it is. I was looking at the other, because the other things were older shows, and I was looking at, like, who lasted that long in a sitcom standpoint. You know, Simpsons, not multi-camera, it's animated 25 years. Jack, Benny, Ozzie and Harriet, and My Three Sons, which weren't necessarily, you know, those live sitcom, multi-camera type of shows. That's a pretty small, cool group to be a part of, you know?
Yes, and it sort of made me realize that as much as the craziness that came with the show was tough. I think it somehow extended the life of it. You know, I mean, who knows that it would have lasted that long had we not had all the drama.
Sure. Well, I'll tell you, the new book, which documents so much of that and your life, So It Happened, it's a fun read. And, you know, I was looking at the very beginning, you know, you came from a show business family. You quickly figured out, I think, as you were becoming a teenager, that you yourself wanted to join the family business and become an actor.
Yeah, you know, my parents had a kind of ambivalent attitude about that because they understood how hard it was, you know. And so when it became clear that it was the direction I wanted to go, I'm sure they would have rathered I had a real civilian job.
A plumber, you know.
Yes, well, a real job, you know, one that you could depend on.
Yeah.
But sadly, I've disappointed them terribly. But there's also the wonderful side of it, which was when times do get hard in the business, I have people who totally understand.
Sure.
And are great to have around.
Well, I'll tell you, we're about the same age, and you know, so you know, grew up in the 70s, in the 80s, and all those Brad Pack films, which you were a part of. You know, I remember No Small Affair, which I believe was your first big film. It starred Demi Moore. It starred George Wendt from Cheers, I think. Correct?
Yes.
Jeffrey Tambor, who's like in Arrested Development, and mm-hmm. all these great little shows. And you know, for first film, I mean, this was your first big film. You were the star. That must have been pretty amazing, and then pretty frightening all at the same time.
Oh, hugely frightening. And also the only movie I'd done to that point was a movie that was actually directed by Robert Altman, of all people.
Wow.
And he has this insane style of filmmaking where he just puts the microphone on you. You have a sort of basic understanding of the way the scene's going to go. And then he sends you out and you make it up as you go along, which is not done normally. So No Small Affair was my introduction into how much more traditional style of movies are made.
Well, and you mentioned the book too. You know, every boy's dream in the 80s, you dated Demi Moore. I mean, good Lord, good God, that's
exactly. that was my that was what I woke up every morning saying. Good God, how did it come to pass? When you are romantically coupled with, as an actor with somebody, a lot of the time the sparks fly in other ways as well.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And so it was, you know, just so such a whirlwind to be in Hollywood, you know, with Demi, who was just coming off of General Hospital.
Right.
And, she really knew the lay of the land. And so she was, taking me around town, and it was really intoxicating.
And, you know, and I didn't know this until I read the book that you dated her. But then I thought, okay, hello, a little degree of separation here. And then you're working with her now husband, Ashton Kutcher. Awkward? Or
somewhat, okay. I think, but only a little. I mean, you know, there was a pretty big gap.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, I would say so.
But I just didn't know if he knew about it or not. You know, I can't imagine, that's pillow talk for the two of them.
Yeah, probably not. I'm going to say probably not. Yeah.
It was a bit awkward.
Now, you officially became a Brad Packer with John Hughes in Pretty in Pink, and it's one of the few films, you know, first of all, being a part of that John Hughes legacy is cool enough on its own, and how popular, you know, Molly Ringwald was in 16 Candles and The Breakfast Club and all that other good stuff. But Pretty in Pink, equally successful movie. Is that one that John didn't direct? Did he direct that one, or did he just write that one?
No, he wrote it and produced it, but actually directed by a guy named Howie Deutsch.
Gotcha. Okay.
Who did a fantastic job and directed some other John Hughes movies as well. John actually was prepping for Ferris Bueller while we were shooting, and that's why he was not available.
Gotcha. Now, you know, a lot of actors and actresses, you know, when they look back at their career, especially their early career, you know, sometimes they don't exactly embrace, you know, some of the characters that they started with. And some of them really do, and they appreciate how they got started in the business and how that character established them. I do remember in an episode of Two and a Half Men that you dressed up as Ducky from Pretty in Pink for that episode. How did that come about?
I had very mixed feelings about that because there's nothing sadder than seeing an old guy trying to look like he's a teenager. Nothing sadder than that. And I was super anxious about that was how that would come off. And I actually made a pact with the costume designer on the show because she was the one who had dressed me up. And I said, if I can't get away with this, you have to pull the plug. You have to say, this is just sad, John.
but
she did not. And we got away with it. To me, it's an honor. It's an honor to have gotten to play a character like that and to be a part of a movie that people still take to their heart. You know, that's why you become an actor. You don't become an actor so that you can do films that that nobody cares about.
Exactly.
What's the point of that?
But it's a generation that people grew up with all these films. And then right after that, I mean, with the success of movies like Airplane and Naked Gun came Hot Shots in 91. And that's where you first met your co-star of Two and a Half Men. That's where you first met Charlie Sheen.
Yes. And he was in a phase then of he was known as kind of a hard partying guy. But he was trying to cut it down a little bit so that he was taking his work a little more seriously. And I have to say, he was a dream to work with, and it was remarkable because, everybody, there would be these legendary tales of partying, and then he'd come in and just nail it, and whereas I'd be fumbling around and missing my marks and screwing up a line here and there, he never did. And you were just like, whatever he's thinking, I'll have some of that.
Well, I was going to say, they say that strippers keep you centered.
It's true. I found that to be true.
They're artists. They are artists as well. They absolutely are. But, I mean, that was your first, introduction to him. And then you did a ton of movies and TV over the years. And I remember the famous Teddy Z that was like over on CBS. You did episodes of Darman Greg, The Outer Limits, Mr. Show, which was a classic show. And then it was 2003, you were cast in Two and a Half Men. How did that role come about?
That role came about because it was interesting. They were having a horrible time casting somebody opposite Charlie. The cast came together in every other way very easily. They found Angus and Charlie almost concurrently. The thing was basically written for Charlie, and they had that core. But then spent weeks and weeks meeting actors and could not find somebody to play Alan. But part of the reason they had so much difficulty was that CBS had forbade them from asking me to do it. because for whatever set of reasons, Les Moonves just did not feel I was a good casting choice. So it wasn't until very late in pilot season that they finally let me audition. But to his credit, Les, turn around on a dime. All he had to do was see me once, and he said, "Okay, win this one." And when we got on with making the show,
and the rest is history. So we'll talk about life on the set with Charlie Sheen, porn. Well, Charlie Sheen and porn, they kind of go together. Divorce, marriage, again, and much more with John Cryer and his new book, So That Happened. Next on 720 WGN.
You've been to couples counseling, right?
Yeah. Why?
I'm going with Chelsea, and I need to know what I'm getting into.
Oh, you're going to love it.
I am?
Absolutely. Once a week, you sit on a couch with your significant other while she snips off your testicles, reaches up inside your chest cavity, and goes like this. To your heart.
That doesn't sound very good.
Oh, it's horrible. But it's worth it because you're paying a stranger to watch while your life goes down the toilet. Along with your money, and your house, and your car, and every last shred of your self-respect.
Maybe you're not the right guy to ask.
I'm the perfect guy to ask. When Judith and I started, we were just a couple with a few problems. When we finished, I came to live on your couch!
Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're talking with actor John Cryer in his new memoir, So That Happened. So what propelled you to write the book? What'd you say, was it the end of the series? Was it life experiences that you wanted to get down on paper? Like, how did this come together?
Well, I lost a bet. Basically, my manager and agent had said to me they thought they could get me a book deal. I was incredibly dubious, but said, hey, look, if you can, I'll write a book. But like I said it with that sort of tone, like, hey, good luck with that, you know. and within a week or two, they got me a deal. So I was sort of stuck.
What do you do? You know, what do you write? What do you put down?
Well, exactly. I mean, where do you start? And, you know, the book is, you have to decide what the story of your life is.
Sure.
And lives don't really necessarily have a story. You know, they're just something, one thing happened after another.
But it must have been cool to be reflective, because, I mean, you probably had to really go back and think about, like, how, you know, because, as a normal human being, you don't sit there and say, well, this was the path, this was the journey, it just kind of happened. But then you got to kind of go back and look at it and see how it really kind of worked for you.
Yes, and you also realize how many things you just remembered wrong, because
wow.
Memory is very tricky, and a lot of the time, if you tell a story over and over, it slightly morphs here and there and becomes different over time. And so what I tried to do was really research a lot of stuff and make sure that I was being accurate. But I also took a lot of old friends out to lunch and just, you know, plied them for stories and said, hey, you know, is there anything you remember from that time? And that was great. It was a great excuse to talk to people that I hadn't talked to in a long time.
You know, and you talk about people, you know, that obviously mentored you over the years and so forth, but there was so many entertaining behind-the-scenes stories, too, like of Two and a Half Men, you know, in your relationship with Charlie. And here's a handful of highlights that I found just fascinating. You know, early on the series, you and Charlie, I don't know if you were both in the middle of your divorces or you were just in the beginning of them. And, you know, Charlie had quite a porn stash in his trailer for entertainment for everybody.
Yes, but apparently he didn't want it around when his wife, Denise Richards, came to visit.
gotcha.
So I was the recipient of a sort of emergency, hey, can you just hold this for a little while?
That's nice.
Okay, sure, Charlie, I'll, you know. But I feel terrible because I, you know, he handed me this brown paper bag full of something, and I had to look.
Of course you
and in retrospect, I'm glad that it was just porn, because God knows what else it could have been.
Yeah, that's true. Well, and then, you know, I know that after he got divorced, you know, he wanted to make sure that you knew that his sex life was on track and everything was okay, and he would share some photos with you as well.
Yes.
Of his experiences. Shall
we say, more than R-rated photos. anatomically explicit photos, but only that. Not the rest of the person, which was fascinating to me, because you know, it meant to me that his relationship was with that and not the the human being it was attached to.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that's true. Yeah.
Yes, but you know what? I don't judge.
Not at all. No, not at all.
Clearly.
And I know, though, when you got divorced and you wrote about this, you speak openly about, you know, Charlie being kind enough, you know, to get you a prostitute after your divorce. And first of all, I'm sure he's a great resource for that. But I assume that was also
Well, go ahead. But I do have to actually clarify on that. That is a bit of a misrepresentation. He did not actually acquire anybody for me. He merely was a proponent.
Gotcha.
Of the world's oldest profession.
You should go get
the Chamber of Commerce for the world's oldest profession if he could.
Well,
put out brochures.
But I mean, you know,
very helpful in that regard.
But after divorce, I mean, you're kind of self-esteem's a little off, and you got to get your mind off things. It's kind of hard to kick it into gear and move forward. And well, maybe that's the right key to go, you know, and try something new.
Yeah, I, as I said, it's not my proudest moment, but I felt like the book was an opportunity to be honest about it.
Absolutely.
And it also it ended up being a funny story. So I thought, well, okay, if it's a funny story, it's got to go in.
Yeah. Absolutely. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, you also talk about, you know, the first seven seasons were pretty steady. And I think a lot of people think, because of what happened at the end, that there are always these ongoing tensions on the set, especially with creator Chuck Lorre. And, you know, that wasn't really the case. I mean, it really just kind of happened right there at the end.
Well, exactly. And that was what was so mystifying about it when it happened was that, you know, people would come up to me and say, oh, I bet there was stuff going on for years, you know, and there wasn't.
Yeah.
We were as blindsided and astonished by it as the rest of the general public. You know, if Charlie had problems with Chuck, he kept it to himself. And so that's why the whole situation was so perplexing. And I certainly didn't expect it to blow up, you know, across the worldwide internet the way that it did.
Sure. Well, and you talk about, too, that, you know, he still tried to be a professional. He actually worked hard to kind of hide it. I mean, it wasn't a guy that just kind of stumbled on. He kind of played it off pretty good.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, for the first few years of the show, he had clearly decided to be sober and was a terrific coworker. But even when he clearly decided he didn't want to be sober anymore, he still functioned well, you know, but you could tell he was making an effort to overcome it. So it was a mix. You knew that something was up and he wasn't quite the same guy, but he was still able to function.
Sure. Sure. Well, and then you talk about, too, that, you know, you had a hard time yourself deciding what was more disturbing, him loaded or him sober.
Yes. because you feel anybody who's got somebody in their family who's dealing with addiction or a coworker, you wonder who's the real guy.
Yeah.
You know, the sober one or the person when he's using. To this day, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I know when Charlie left Two and a Half Men in 2011, it was pretty turbulent. And as you were saying earlier in the interview or earlier in the conversation, that you didn't know if it was going to continue or if you didn't know if the show was going to go on. And, you know, maybe it could have gone one more season with just you guys, but this really kind of gave it a new kick in the pants and a new life with a new team in front of the camera.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I loved the character, and God knows they got plenty of comedic mileage out of them. But I certainly didn't think, you know, there was four more years of show
left
in them. When you're in the eighth season, when you just finished the eighth season. But you know, we had amazing writers on that show. Did you hear that? I made the mistake of saying we have amazing writers because you know I've been doing the show for 12 years.
Yeah.
We have amazing writers on the show.
I bet.
And it comes waves.
You know, I bet it does.
There are times when I'm sure that the show is still on.
It is, and it is everywhere, and it's kicking butt in the ratings too, even on cable and TBS and WGN and every place else. It's still going strong. Well, I'll tell you, funny book. It's So That Happened, as well as the audio book is available as well at Amazon.com, wherever books are sold. You can follow John on Twitter, and you can find out what he's doing next. John, absolute pleasure sharing some stories and hanging out with us tonight.
Okay, thank you. Such a pleasure.
All right, much more ahead on 720 WGN.
Now, let's see, some eyes that say, don't you want to go on a date with me, Florence?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yes. Not kidding. All right. Hang on there now. Hang on there. Now, listen, I'm not going to send you out looking like any old ragtag either. We are going to do the hotel statuary up in fine style. Look at this bow tie. Little bow tie there. Got this straight from Fred Astaire. Yes, I did. Look at that. Yes.
It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. It's hard for me to imagine growing up in Chicago without the memorable television shows and amazing talent that graced our airwaves. One of my favorites is Bill Jackson, who is celebrating the big 8-0 this week. Now, I discovered Giggle Snort Hotel, which was must-watch viewing every Sunday morning, but many of my friends, a tad older than me, revere Bill from the days of Cartoon Town. BJ and the Dirty Dragon, shows that I've had the privilege to see and own over the years. Now, in 2009, I had the honor of spending a couple of days with Bill and his lovely wife, Jo, for his final Chicago performance for the Museum of Broadcast Communications. And I'm honored again that this Emmy Award-winning and National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences Silver Circle honoree is taking some time to join us tonight. Good evening to you, Bill.
Good evening to you, David. You were talking there, and I had a great image of you helping me set up the puppets.
Right.
And you were getting such a kick out of that, and we're putting them on stands, and you inserting the stands up into the puppets was really something to watch.
Yeah. Well, and what I loved was the stands were plungers.
That's right.
Well, they're iconic. They're as iconic as you to actually see those puppets up close. We'll talk about that in a little bit because they're at the museum. They are amazing, and they just brought me back to my childhood watching all of your wonderful shows.
Well, thank you very much. You're very kind. And I had to be able to create those puppets, there's a story behind that of itself. And they were different type puppets. They were latex rubber puppets, whereas a great many puppets are foam rubber or foam type. And I had the good fortune to be taught how to build them from a gentleman by the name of Walker Edmonston. And Walker was a very talented, popular actor in Hollywood, but he also had a kid show, and he had created these puppets on the kid show, and it blew me away. I got to know him, and he was so kind in teaching me how to make them, and then that, now we jump right up to when you were sticking rubber plunger up.
Well, what we learned too is, made out of latex, those puppets weren't meant to last 40 to 50 years.
Yes, rubber, I hate to use the word, but rubber rots. I mummified them, David. The ones that are at the museum, I spent a lot of time on.
You did.
And most of them are original. I think I only had to recast one, maybe two at the most. But at any rate, I mummified them so that they will stand a little longer test of time than they normally would.
Well, I'll tell you, for those who grew up in the 60s to the 80s, and you know, the legends that are still with us, you know, Don Sandberg from Bozo Circus, Marshall Brodeen, Joey DiOrio, and you.
Oh,
and
those guys are great.
Those wonderful gentlemen. And, you know, but you are part of a pretty elite group of Chicago broadcasters. You really are.
Wow.
Was this news? Was this news?
Thank you, David.
Absolutely. Well, I want to dip back a little bit. You grew up in Unionville, Missouri, and very early on, you were inspired by the art of the comic book.
Yes, that's right. That's right. My best buddy, Roger Torrey, and I were going to grow up to be comic book cartoonists, and we loved the cartoon. And we tried to put a comic strip together while we were kids. I don't know what we would have done with it. I mean, once we had it, it was just the fun of doing it. And his drawing looked like Prince Valiant, and mine looked like Little Lulu.
Okay.
So we had a little trouble getting together.
That's funny. That's funny. Well, I mean, so talented that you are. And you also had some inspiration in your life from your dad. Your father worked for a traveling carnival. So, I mean, from an entertainment perspective, you saw a lot of that and were exposed to that at a young age, too.
Yes, I did. I did, David. You know, I had an incredible childhood, and that's where The Only Kid on the Carnival came from. That was the book I wrote, and it tells about my days on the carnival. That's how it starts, and it moves on from there. But, you know, at that young age, and now we're going back to when I was 4 or 5, just going into grade school, and my hero was Gorilla Man, the wrestler, and my best friend was Del Mar, who was the trapeze clown on the carnival. And you know, when you're around people like that, you know, it really leaves an impression on you.
I bet.
And so my dad and mom had those, what was called a mug joint.
What was that?
Carney Talk. And, you know, David, when you go to the mall and you sit in the booth and have your picture taken?
Yeah.
That's a mug joint.
Oh, okay. All right.
That's, but on the carnival, it was portable. And my dad got me into showbiz early by teaching me how to develop a film. And I'd disappear in the back developing room. I mean, this is a pretty small box we were in.
It's like a photo booth.
And the big treat was I was about 5 years old, and people would sit and have their picture taken, and this five-year-old would come out with a developed film. So
wow.
Dad was sort of trading on that a little bit. But,
yeah. Yeah, but that's a very young age to be exposed to that. I know you graduated from University of Missouri with a degree in journalism, television production. Your first job was at KTVO in Iowa, and you wore many hats like you did back then in the industry.
Well, you know, David, I was blessed by it. Well, let me back up a little. The University of Missouri School of Journalism, I think, is just an outstanding school, and they give you some hands-on training. When I came out of there, I had worked in a television studio. I had done most of the jobs. And when I went to KTVO, I was hired initially as a radio. They had a radio station also. And I was hired as a radio copywriter. But I was soon put to work running camera and then became the cartooning weatherman. And may I drop a name, P.J. Hoff.
Yeah.
Chicago should remember P.J. Hoff.
Absolutely.
I was so influenced by him. And I started doing, they'd asked me to cartoon the weather, which I did. And I want to jump ahead just briefly here.
Yeah.
Years later, when I was at WBBM, I got to know P.J. Hoff and became friends with him. A lot of people became friends with P.J. He was just a really great guy. And he gave me he had a little booklet of his television tricks that he did on his show. He had a lot of hidden wires and things that he would do to make his cartoons move. And he gave me that book as a personal gift.
Wow.
I have it. And I cherish his memory. You want to talk about someone who knew how to treat people on camera and off? That was P.J. Hall.
Oh, that's very cool. That's very cool. And then obviously an influence on you as well. Yeah. Wow. Very, very, very cool. Now, I know you mentioned you were illustrating the weather. I know you entered the service. You joined the Armed Forces Radio Network, where you started exploring puppetry a little bit. How did that first kind of come to mind that you wanted to get into that and into puppetry?
Well, you know, I'm writing my memoir, and what you're asking is in that memoir. But I will... I say my memoir of my professional life, my life in children's television. The first book was my childhood. Armed Forces Radio and TV was half civilian, half military. And I was the staff artist, but I also was a writer-director. I also was a PFC, David.
Okay, gotcha. All right.
They didn't have to pay much for what I was
right.
doing. But Uncle Mildy was the head of the writers, and his office was right next to my little art cubicle there.
Wow.
And he came over and he said, Bill, you've got to come and see this. And I didn't know what he had in mind. It was about 3 in the afternoon or so, maybe 4. And I went in there, and he had his TV on, and KHJ television out in L.A. was what he had up, and Walker Edmondson, I mentioned him previously,
mm-hmm, yeah.
He was on there with his kid show and those puppets, and I was just enthralled. I watched him, I looked at those puppets, and something clicked, and away I went.
Well, yeah, but there was something to be said for wanting to get into the business and be behind the scenes, but you wanted to build them too. I mean, from an artist's perspective, you wanted to make these beautiful puppets as well.
Yeah, that's right. Well, David, creating things is just part of me,
yeah,
you know.
Sure.
For better or for worse, but that's what I like to do. I like to create them. I like to design the sets. I didn't build them and paint them.
Yeah, but you designed
them.
Yeah.
I was interested in that. And I enjoyed that part and the creating of the puppets and the doing the cartooning on the air and the whole thing.
Well, we're talking to Chicago TV legend Bill Jackson, and there's more with him next on 720 WGN.
Pearl, are you feeling any better?
No, yes, Fenster. I can't imagine what made me so grumpy.
I don't care what BJ says. I heard something sneaking around back there.
Hey, it's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN, and we're celebrating the 80th birthday of Bill Jackson, and we're talking about iconic shows Cartoon Town, BJ and the Dirty Dragon, and Giggle Snort Hotel.
Now, the first children's show was in Fort Wayne, Indiana. It was 1960. Popeye and the Little Rascals Club. Many of the children's shows of those days, especially the local broadcasts, had, you know, a live host, but they played classic shorts, the Bugs Bunnies, the Popeyes, the Little Rascals, the Stooges. And that's kind of how your first show launched.
That's right. I was hired to do that. And the fact that I was, and this was my first on air, really, as far as a performer, so I was pretty gutsy. I don't know where I got the idea I could do that, but I did do it. And but my imagination was already saying, well, we're not just going to go out and go blah 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 and introduce a cartoon. And I had my first two puppets with me, Fergie and Morty Martian. So I operated them, and then I just kept adding things and building on to what I was doing, and I was drawing, and then pretty soon I had a panel of kids who were guessing what I was drawing, a cartoon character, of course, and it just went on from there.
Now, you also
I wasn't content to just introduce the cartoon.
Right. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And then there was a change to the Bill Jackson show right after that in Indiana, or was that a different show altogether?
Well, it was in Indiana. You're right. I went from Fort Wayne to Indianapolis, and I took the Mickey Mouse Club. Disney was doing the reruns on it, and WLWI in Indianapolis wanted a host for that.
Oh, interesting.
But from the get-go, they started with a bigger show than I had in Fort Wayne. I took that on. It had a live audience and the reruns of the Mouseketeers. And Jimmy Dodd came to the show. And cool. I wish Annette had come to the show.
Yeah, right. But still pretty cool. Wow, yeah. That's awesome.
And Ducky Nash, who did Donald Duck voice. And,
wow.
And I got to work with them. And that's where I created Dirty Dragon. Dirty Dragon initially was a villain. And I started doing skits with the puppets. Well, I'd been doing skits with the puppets, but I branched out considerably. I created the Thump Twangers there because bluegrass music in Indianapolis, you might imagine, it's very popular.
Mm-hmm.
And the people love it. And so the Four Birds, the Thump Twangers, they became bluegrass music guys.
Now, you had that show for a while. CBS in Chicago, WBBM, came calling in 1965. And with it, all the popularity that Bozo had on WGN, they wanted a clown. So clowns were big back then.
Yeah.
And thus came Clown Alley and Here Comes Freckles.
Yes.
Now,
what would you like to know about that?
Well, it's funny to me because, you know, for all the talent that they must have seen, samples of your shows and so forth, why they had to put you behind the clown face, I didn't quite get that, you know, because, I mean, there was something, you know, in a clown, you're kind of hiding a little bit behind the makeup,
right,
and so forth. And, it really wasn't yourself.
Well, I'll be honest, David, it was tough for me.
Yeah.
I remember sitting on the edge of my bed in Indianapolis saying, do you really want to do this? Well, I wanted to stay alive and stay employed, so yes. I the answer was yes.
Sure, sure.
But let me just jump ahead a little bit. And when that show closed out, the manager of the station did me a humongous favor because this normally is very expensive. He let me cut a pilot to show other stations. They felt, I guess he felt badly that they were having to let me go, but they were. And there were different reasons for that. But he let me shoot a pilot. And, of course, I shot it as myself. And when I had finished, and I'd fired off every gun I could. And when I'd finished, one of the stagehands came up to me and said, "They should have let you be you to begin with."
Right. Yeah. Right. No, you told me that story before, and I've always found that fascinating.
Oh.
Yeah. No, but you know, over breakfast. But I couldn't believe that. You know, you would never think about that today. That they would say, "Hey, you know what? We're done here. But why don't you use our studios? We'll let you produce a." That's pretty amazing, actually. That's a very cool thing. Yeah.
You're talking big bucks with the crews and all that.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, then WFLD Channel 32 came calling. In 1968, where Cartoon Town was born. You were the mayor of Cartoon Town. You were yourself with a cast of characters. Let's talk about all those amazing characters you brought to the small screen, because, you know, I could not hear those voices enough. I could not see those characters enough. They are classic to me.
Well, I created a lot of new puppets, David, for that show. I had Dirty Dragon. And if I was going to be the mayor, I thought, well, I'll cast him as the postmaster who eats the mail. That's a
I love that.
That's a natural.
Natural, thing. Absolutely.
You know, and have fun with that. And I created the first time they ever aired, but Mother Plumtree and the old professor was actually left over and is another story. But I teamed them together, and Mother Plumtree had the boarding house, and also living in the boarding house were Weird and Wally, Wally Good Scout, and Weird was just Weird. And let's see who
Weird.
Else
Weird, I love the dragon.
On there.
I loved the dragon, but I think Weird might have been my favorite, hands down, hands down. Anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt.
You probably know somebody in your family like that.
Yeah,
right?
Probably. Probably. Yeah.
Well, Weird was a very solid character for me. Also, I had the Blob. Now, I had created the Blob on the Clown Alley show, and there's a story behind how that happened. But at any rate, I featured him as the town monument. And, of course, you couldn't understand what he said, which made it, I think, all that more appealing.
Mm-hmm. How did that sound exactly? How did that? I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you to do a little Blob for
you
us.
You want
tonight.
A little Blob?
Could we get just a little Blob
here on
from
my
Bill
80th
Jackson?
Birthday?
On your 80th birthday, I'm asking you to perform. Oh, that's fabulous! I just needed a little bit of that. All right, I'm sorry. A great.
Put that in a bottle, I might say.
I will. Yes, let's do that. Let's do that for sure. Let's do that for sure. I still
you
think
have to
you
be a little crazy, David. You know, I mean.
I've heard that to be in this industry. I think that's maybe why I'm doing all right. I'm a little off my rocker,
sure
right?
You are doing something right, or you wouldn't be where you are right now. But you've seen the stage shows that I've done in Chicago.
Absolutely.
I mean, coming back to do them. And remember that people out of the audience got a big kick out of the Sound Like Blob contest. And some people really can do a good Blob.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not as good as... I struggle a little bit. I have a cousin that does it almost point on. It's just kind of crazy. But these characters, though, I mean, I got to tell you, especially when you were doing the Blob, and I was watching a clip that we're playing as one of the bumps tonight. You know, it was so overly loud. You know, over you, and it was so much silliness and fun because you were creating something. And there was times that you didn't quite know where you were going with something and with the eyes and the mouth and all that of the blob itself. And you just knew it was going to be something fun, and the voice just enhanced the experience of watching you create something. It just did.
Well, thank you. You know, Jim Shaw, who's no longer with us, unfortunately, but Jim was my audio man at WFLD, and he was just excellent. He figured into any sound we had, music, sound effects, all of that. He was just excellent, but he was a very pressured job.
So many memories, Bill, and you are a true television icon. And today, this week, we celebrate 80 years of Bill Jackson on this planet, and we're lucky to have you, and happy birthday, my friend.
Oh, thank you, David. Thank you.
It has been a great pleasure, and I appreciate you also taking some time for us tonight.
Okay, and I just leave you with this.
Yes, sir.
There's no mail today.
Oh, you couldn't end any better than that, Bill. Thank you so much. Thank you again, buddy. All right. Much more ahead on 720 WGN.
Legendary NBC News anchor Tom Brokaw is the author of six best-selling books, The Greatest Generation, The Greatest Generation Speaks, An Album of Memories, Boom, The Time of Our Lives, and A Long Way Home. Tom has been with NBC nearly 50 years and from 83 to 2004 was the sole anchor and managing editor of NBC Nightly News. And last year he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And now comes his new book, A Lucky Life Interrupted. It's a powerful memoir of a year of dramatic change, a year spent battling cancer and reflecting on that long, happy, and lucky life. And he joins us this morning. Good morning to you, Tom.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
Same here. Now, your inspiration, Tom, for this book was pretty simple. Cancer touches almost every family in this country, and regardless of the resources you have or might not have, it taught you some life lessons to share.
Well, the first thing that I learned is that if one member of the family has cancer, everybody has cancer in the family, because it becomes, in a way, a familial experience, and the support team really begins with your family. They're not quite as they're not more important than your medical team, but they're right there with the medical team, because it requires emotional support. It also requires another mind thinking about what is the best way of getting at this, and making your friends and other members of the family aware of what you're going through, so that you can concentrate on getting well and not pick up the phone every 30 seconds and saying, look, I'm doing the best that I can, because everybody is concerned about you. In my case, I was very, very fortunate. My eldest daughter is a physician, and she's very good at what she does. So she was my ombudsman. You know, she would sit in on the conference calls, be there when the examinations were going on, ask the right questions, the questions that I wouldn't know to ask. And then my wife was my tough cop. You know, she said, no, you're not going to get on the airplane, Tom, and go do these things. You've just got to spend all of your time getting well again. The other members of the family were the cheerleaders. They'd bring me gossip. You know, they'd do some research on other things that were going on in my kind of cancer. So it became a family experience.
Yeah. Now, a couple of years ago, Tom, when you were first noticed that something was wrong, you know, your family and friends noticed you just weren't yourself. You had some unexplainable back pain, and you had a blood test 9 months earlier, and it detected nothing at the time. And most people would think that another blood test 9 months later would reveal any different results.
Well, one of the things that I became aware of, this is a small population cancer, but it's a nasty one. It's called multiple myeloma. It does strike more and more across a broader part of the population, but it really does strike at men a lot more than others, men who get into their 60s and 70s. And the back pain was a result of bone damage, because it's a bone marrow cancer. And I've now talked to even physicians who said, you know, I'm a golfer, I'm a tennis player, I thought I was just going through some athletic injuries. That's exactly what happened to me. They delayed getting a blood test. The blood test then lit up the fact that I had cancer, and my system was 60% involved. I had a hole in my pelvis that I didn't know about. I had two fractures in my lower back. Later had spinal fractures as well. So it's a cautionary tale. I keep telling men who are roughly in my age group, look, if you get a back pain, It's not just because, you know, you're overswinging your golf game or you're wading some tough streams when you're fishing. Go get a blood test.
And I know most people won't think that. And I know you're on the board for the Mayo Clinic. You talked to some of the doctors about your pain at the time. And when anyone is diagnosed with cancer, it's always a delicate subject, obviously. And the way a patient is told varies, you know, depending on the circumstances of that person, usually told when other family members or spouse is pregnant or a partner is pregnant. But when it came down to your doctor sitting down with you and talking to you about your diagnosis, they were quite direct because I think they knew who they were dealing with.
Well, what happened is that I went to a second orthopedist at Mayo Clinic. I'd gone to one in New York. I'd been dealing with him for a long time. Look, I'm a very active outdoorsman. I biked across South America earlier that year. I'd been doing a lot of bird hunting. I was fishing in tough streams in Montana. And the orthopedist all thought that it was a result of being a little bit older and putting my back through a difficult ordeal. My primary care physician, who is an internist at the Mayo Clinic, said, something else is going on here, Tom. It shouldn't last this long. So he did the blood test. Then he brought in the hematologist, and they sat there and read off the screen what sounded to me like an SAT test. You know, they talked to M-spike and proteins.
Yeah.
And then they turned to me at the end, the hematologist did, and said, you've got a malignancy. It's called multiple myeloma. And his next phrase was, you know people who've died from this. Geraldine Ferraro, the first woman to run for vice president, Frank Reynolds, the ABC anchorman. I was always a little confused about what claimed Frank's life. And then it turned out that Frank McGee, the former NBC Today host, had died of it. And we all wonder what would happen when we're confronted with that kind of news. In my case, I was surprisingly calm. I kind of was two parts, you know, the human part and the journalist part. And the journalist part kicked in. I wanted a lot of answers to a lot of questions.
Of course.
And I knew I was in for a long ordeal. I didn't think it was going to be quite as difficult as it turned out to be.
Well, you know, you said 25,000 people are diagnosed with this. It's a very rare blood cancer, incurable but treatable. It certainly can change perspective on life. And you mentioned in the book, you think about mortality differently. You are still a young guy. If you were 93, that would be one thing, but you were 73 when you were diagnosed. But it made you realize, in your words, that there are no more long-term leases.
You are forced to confront the reality of mortality. My lucky life has been that we've never had anything go wrong in our family, really seriously wrong. And the ER physician daughter used to say, I wonder if we could handle it. And this was a test for us. I breezed through my 73rd birthday not even thinking that I was entering the mortality stage, because I was able to do pretty much what I wanted to do. Now I began to develop priorities. First, get well. Second, concentrate on only those things that mean the most to you. That means spending more time with your family, more time with, I suppose, writing and other professional occupations that I wanted to concentrate on. And one of my friends said to me, how's your tolerance for jerks? And although he used a more colorful phrase,
I'm sure, yeah,
I said, it's down to zip.
Yeah, right.
You quickly just say, okay, these are people I want to spend time with. Those are people I don't want to spend time with.
Absolutely. Well, and plus you talk about, too, you know, one of your daughters, Jennifer, was interested in talking about, you know, sometimes it's very difficult to talk to parents about families, about, you know, needs and care and end of life. And families really need to sit down and talk about these things in advance. And, of course, that's one of the more difficult subjects to discuss. And, you know, you had mentioned you had a lawyer put things together some years ago, and your daughter said, well, we need to all be involved in this, Dad. But initially you didn't even know where the paperwork was filed, but it's important to get your family involved in some of this stuff. What does quality of life mean? Like, what, you know, everyone has to be in on this.
Well, there's certain fundamental things that I learned, and you would think that we would all think the same way. Most patients enter a doctor's office as if it's a Mayan temple, and they don't speak the language. You need to force the physicians and the caregivers to speak in plain language, ask tough questions, get a second opinion on all of the treatments that they're recommending. And if you say to them, look, I'd like to get somebody else to take a look at this, I've been doing some research, most good physicians will say, you should do that. Here's somebody that, it's at Sinai, for example, in Los Angeles, or at Columbia Presbyterian in New York, or at Northwestern in Chicago. And then what you do is get your family organized so everybody has a role. And Jennifer was key in that. And she said, the caregivers can't get exhausted. For for example, in most caregiving experiences, the women step up. It's a kind of a maternal instinct. It really needs to be spread out through the family. You know, the guy's got to get involved. You have to have a plan going in, and you should make that plan before some kind of disaster strikes so everyone knows what the role is. And in that case, it becomes almost like a game plan. And in that, in our case, that turned out to work very well.
Before I let you go, Tom, I wanted to ask you, you know, from a news perspective, you know, nightly news broadcast audiences have shrunk a bit since you've been in the chair. There's so much access to news. Is it overkill, or does it just make everyone work a little harder to produce a more quality broadcast?
Well, I have a surprising answer to that. I think that if you're proactive in where you get your news, you've never had more great choices. You can't be a couch potato. You know, there was a time when I was growing up and you just had Huntley and Brinkley and Walter Cronkite. That was it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And most of the news that you got was through the prism of middle-aged white men. Fine by me. I was going to be one of them. Now you've got this extraordinary range of stuff, and a lot of it is, you know, it's designed to destroy the fabric of life. A lot of it is they don't pay much attention to the veracity of what they're saying. But with a keystroke now, I can get up in the morning, go on my computer, read my hometown newspaper, read the Chicago newspapers, read the commentators that I like best. I have a friend who's the editor of the Financial Times of London, does the best international reporting. Bang. Keystroke, I can read what they're doing.
Well, I'll tell you what, legendary news anchor Tom Brokaw, the new book is A Lucky Life Interrupted, available wherever books are sold. And if you'd like to find out more about the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation, I encourage you to go visit MMRF.org. Tom, thank you again for spending some time with us, sharing your journey, and have a wonderful holiday weekend.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm still a lucky guy, and I'm very grateful. And I'm especially fond of your city. I really am. I've been out there three times, I think, in the last 3 months or so, and I never fail to have a good time.
Next time you're in town, come see us.
Okay, I will do.
All right, pal. Have a good one.